The case regarding Roe versus Wade is now in.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so this is the case that involves Roe v. Wade, established 49 years ago. The decision is out. It's been issued by Justice Alito, and Roe v. Wade, according to our reports from the U.S. Supreme Court and our own Shannon Bream, is that Roe v. Wade has been overturned, and the question of abortion has been returned to the states.
Welcome back. Another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Dr. E. Michael Jones back on the show. Of course, he's the editor of Culture Wars magazine, the author of several books, including Logos Rising, A History of Ultimate Reality, and the recently released second edition of The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History. Anytime, the book on art?
It was supposed to be shipped today, but we're still waiting for confirmation of that fact.
Okay, and the title for that book again, I'm sorry?
It's called The Dangers of Beauty, The Conflict Between Mimesis and Concupiscence in the Fine Arts.
Excellent. So, well, tonight, had you back on, of course, we can talk about this reversal of Roe versus Wade and the Casey decision, the end of abortion as a constitutional right in the United States. It's remanded back to the states. No immediate change, really. Man, there's some trigger laws that are being impacted, but really the geography of abortion isn't really going to change much. Infanticide in California, New York, and maybe Illinois, more regulated throughout the various states. I want to have you get your take on so this January 6th show trial and sort of the, I guess you could say, the attempt by the Democrats to criminalize political dissent and how the regime is supporting, encouraging anarcho-tyranny, almost encouraging a crime wave or not doing anything about it. We've had that recall of Chesa Boudin, child of Jewish terrorist. He was the prosecutor in San Francisco that was recalled, and I think Gascon might be facing a recall attempt. These Soros DAs have really made an impact on the country, unfortunately. So first, Roe v. Wade. The Supreme Court has said it was a bad decision, and it's been reversed. And now we're at a status quo ante, 1973. Although a lot of water under the bridge, a lot of blood has flowed. And so the collateral damage is immense. So where are we now with this?
Well, I think that the main collateral damage is contempt for the rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're seeing across the country now. There were more than 100 Soros prosecutors who now say they're not going to prosecute. Well, they're not going to follow the law. Well, wait a minute, who's going to follow it then? These are the chief law enforcement agents in cities across the country, and they said they're not going to follow the law. Well, didn't they take an oath to enforce the law? Don't you take an oath to do that? And now they're not going to do that? So who's going to get rid of them?
Commissars don't take oaths, do they?
Well, that's the point that I'm trying to get to here.
Yeah.
So the legacy of Roe versus Wade is basically the whole idea of equality before the law was abolished. So now, after Roe versus Wade, there are two categories. It used to be one, now there are two. And one category is the fetus. And the fetus has no rights whatsoever, not even the most basic right, which is the right to life. And on the other side, you have a group of people, you could call them the aborting mother. And these people are not only have rights, they have privilege. They have the privilege. They have the privilege to, you can't have a right to do this, but they have the privilege to kill another person. And it's becoming very clear now that this is Jewish privilege, that it was basically the Jews who gave us abortion. Bernard Nathanson made that clear in his memoir when he talked about this arising basically in New York City. It was concocted in New York City. He got together with a man by the name of Lawrence Lader. They were going to discuss James Joyce, the Irish writer, and conversation turned to abortion. We're talking about the late 60s right now. And they decided they're going to do something, and they had powerful allies on their side, the most powerful being the New York Times, which was also in the business of basically confecting other projects at the time. This is a time when the civil rights movement collapsed, and so the Jewish support shifted from the Martin Luther King to the State of Israel. It's also the time that the Holocaust narrative came into being in a serious fashion. And I'm talking about the book, Jesse Kosinski's book, The Painted Bird, which became a bestseller, one of the biggest sellers of 1967. This is the era that we're talking about now. And so you're seeing the rise, basically, of Jewish power at this point. So the net result is now, as an American citizen, you fall into either one of two categories. You're either a mother or a fetus. If you're a mother, you have Jewish privilege. If you're a fetus, you have no rights whatsoever. And so what happens then after that is the government tries to maneuver you into the category where you have no rights. If they can maneuver you into that category, then they win the battle. So it wasn't just the fetus. Suddenly it gets expanded to include other undesirable groups. So the first example I could give was the white boys who showed up at Charlottesville. It's not a crime to be white, although it looks as if it's heading in that direction. They mistakenly assembled there. They asked for a permit to do this. They assembled there because they felt they had the rights guaranteed them by the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, First Amendment, right to free speech, right to assemble. Turns out that that's wrong. It's wrong because of Roe versus Wade. What they didn't understand is that white is the same term as fetus. And if you're a fetus, you have no rights whatsoever. And then you can expand that, bring that forward even a little bit further, and you have the January 6th so-called insurrection, which is a complete category of the mind confected by the media and the Justice Department to basically demonize Trump supporters and deprive them of the rights. They were deprived of the right because a label had been applied to them. The label is insurrection. And as soon as that was applied, the Trump supporters who came there to protest what they felt was a stolen election were suddenly in the category of fetus. And once you're in that category, you have no rights. And so they're being treated as if they have no rights. This is the long-term legacy of versus have equality before the being replaced. We have groups who are now enforcing the privilege of these groups. And I'm talking about the Soros prosecutors who now say they're not going to enforce Roe versus Wade. If you're a part of these privilege, if you're Antifa, you have Jewish privilege, you can burn down the city after the George Floyd thing, and they'll call it, the media will call it peaceful protest. This is the situation.
Yeah, I think it was Michigan's Attorney General, Danny Nessel, who earlier had said that it's great, all schools should have drag queens in them because it's fun. And she came out recently and said she wouldn't enforce any, I guess, prohibitions or restrictions on abortion just, you know, I guess not feeling obligated to
Yes.
follow any laws.
She. Yeah, well, who's custodia ipsos custodes? Who's going to be the guardian of the people who are supposed to be the guardians? Who's going to enforce the law against the law enforcement? We have reached the point where law enforcement now, certainly under Merrick Garland, is a weapon to be used against political opponents. Again, we see the same strategy in place here. Dana Nessel was put into office with Soros money. She's the local, the she's the state equivalent of the district attorney general for the state of Michigan. She was recently involved in a plot against the people of Michigan, a plot she concocted with the FBI, claiming that there were a group of people in Michigan were going to kidnap the governor, row her out to the middle of Lake Michigan, and hold her hostage until they came up with $57.43 in ransom money, or maybe it was more. I don't know. So that case is not the first time that the FBI has gone to war against the people of Michigan, involving one of their usual entrapment schemes. The first one was called the Hootery. Nobody remembers that, but that was six guys from a trailer park with one 22 rifle and three bullets. And it turns out that they didn't have the rifle because the guy, the main plotter, his mother took it away from him. Now, the only reason they were considered serious is because the FBI showed up. There were an equal number of FBI agents who were supplying them with, serious weapons and bombs and so on and so forth. That case collapsed immediately. As soon as it went to trial, it collapsed as an entrapment case. Same thing is happening now with Dana Nessel's conspiracy with the FBI. It's collapsing as entrapment. The two of them pled guilty to a lesser charge just to get rid of the thing.
Yeah, and of course we see this double standard at work now. I think in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision on Roe, there was a mob that attacked the Arizona legislature, and no one called them insurrectionists. And as I'm not aware of any investigation in arresting those participating in that riot in front of the legislature, disrupting a governmental, I guess, procedure. This is something that the again
Right.
that the January 6 people are accused of doing. You had the that incident with Stephen Colbert, the alleged comedian, who sent in a troop of I guess of performers to interrupt Congress to mock or disrupt the activities of, was it Boebert of Colorado, the Republican congresswoman from Colorado. But they entered illegally with the aid of Adam Schiff and a couple other Congress critters, and those people are not being held in solitary confinement. They're not being called insurrectionists. They're allowed to go home. I doubt they'll serve a day in jail. We also have this spectacle. Well, we have the violence, of course. The month of rage, because we got a teaser with the Dodd versus Jackson decision when that leaked memo came out, and give us a hint of how the court was going to go on this. And we had groups like Jane's Revenge or Ruth Sent Us threatening to break the law. There's all types of reports of many reports of crisis pregnancy centers being vandalized, attacked, or churches being attacked. But there is, and this is interstate, and Merrick Garland's DOJ doesn't seem very interested in these crimes. He's more willing to go after parents complaining at the school board about critical race theory or the state of education or the COVID restrictions or the fact that the LGBTQ plus IA ideology is being promoted in the schools, or this drag queen story hour. If you complain about that, you may indeed be a terrorist, but if you burn a church down or throw a Molotov cocktail at a crisis pregnancy center, that's okay. That's just passionate. That's a mostly peaceful protest, because Merrick Garland, as he said, thinks that abortion is a right, as if that matters, so.
Yeah, so what the law is has become completely irrelevant. It's what the powerful want. It's whether you have Jewish privilege. Actually, one of the most significant changes that has taken place in the 49-year-old long year abortion wars is the attitude towards the Jews have have suddenly come out all over the place and said that abortion is a fundamental Jewish value. And then they go on to say, there's actually a court case going through the system in Florida where saying that if the government prevents abortion, they are denying the Jews the right to practice their religion. Now, so I tweet, abortion's a Jewish sacrament. And I got all these outraged Jews complaining about me. I said, look, your quarrel is not with me. I mean, okay, I used a Catholic word. You're right. The Jews have no sacraments. Only the Catholic Church has sacraments. But if they did, abortion would be one of them. It's obvious. It's obvious that this is a ritual, has become a ritual, a sacred ritual to these people. And then that leads me to start thinking about the historical context and exactly who are these people? It sounds to me as if they are the descendants of the Moloch worshipers that we heard so much about in the Old Testament. The Jews forever had problems maintaining their covenant with God. They were the chosen people. No sooner did they get out of bondage in Egypt, and they immediately revert to idol worship. Now, this idol worship is not some type of vague fantasy. There was an actual god called Moloch, and the way you worship Moloch was to child sacrifice. You gave your children, and then he gave you worldly riches and so on and so forth in return. So I'm seeing here a direct connection, theological, because you always have to deal with the Jews in theological terms, between these Moloch worshipers and the people who are in favor of abortion. This is so it turns out that what they're saying is the exact opposite of what is true.
Yeah, and you sell that being played out, in reality. Or an example of that view would be Janet Yellen's testimony. She's the Treasury Secretary. She decided to add her two cents worth regarding the abortion issue in May, and she said that abortion is actually good for the economy, because it enables women to seek employment opportunities that they might otherwise not have if they had the burden of childcare. And so there you go. So they can increase their income and status in society. So there is our system allegedly rewarding these women with worldly treasures if they do indeed sacrifice their children.
That's right. Yeah. And on top of that, it's a colossally stupid statement from an economical point of view.
Yeah, I know.
wait a minute. Those people, did you remain a child forever, Janet? Eventually, didn't you grow up? Didn't you grow up and become, don't these children grow up and become productive members of society because of the work they do? Isn't labor the source of all value? Where does labor come from if it doesn't come from human beings? And if you're murdering human beings, where are we going to get our labor force?
Well, they're fighting at that right now with workforce participation being so low. That's actually aggravating the inflation problem, because productivity, they can print money out of nowhere. They can just create it in computers, but they can't print labor out of nowhere, right? That has to exist. I mean, and so now they're finding some people said that's part of the inflation problem is aggravated, not just by the government going crazy with the money printing, but with the shortage of labor, aggravated largely by the people getting sick from the so-called vaccine that's supposed to save
right.
us from the pandemic.
Yeah. I just had a conversation with one of the guys who works for me. He said one third of his generation was aborted. That's one third of the millennial generation is not there,
mm-hmm.
not there to take up their jobs. This is a suicide cult. The people who are running this country belong to a suicide cult.
Yeah, it's almost like World War I in the trenches when you think that generation, that 18, I guess would have been the 1890 generation. How many of that generation died in the trenches? And the effect
and England never recovered.
Never recovered. Yeah.
That was the end of the British Empire. Britannia didn't rule the waves anymore. You've got various manifestations of the suicide cult. Israel now just liberalized its access to abortion. We'll show you, the Israelis say, and somewhere Adolf Hitler is smiling because the Israelis are killing little Jews, okay? But I don't know what they're blinded by their suicide cult. The other suicide cult is Germany, which seems also determined to follow, to implement the Morgenthau plan and destroy Germany. So they're all over the place. It just seems to be proliferating. I don't know. It's a sign of the end times. Things can't go on this way.
Yeah. Now, you do have a situation now where, okay, so it's going to go back to the states, the abortion question, where I think constitutionally, perhaps that's where it should reside. Now, I always thought the 14th Amendment, if you're going to invoke the 14th Amendment in such matters, it could be construed to protect unborn rather than kill unborn, because you could make the much better argument that the 14th Amendment could be expanded to protect unborn life. And these things. So it's one of these things where they use it to, you know, the penumbras of the emanations. That's what the sort of, it's just there somewhere, but one of the things that you're seeing was Clarence Thomas, in his concurring opinion, in the majority opinion in this decision, was bringing into question the broader issue of substantive due process.
Right.
Versus a procedural due process, how this can be the logic of this decision. And although the other justices said no, I think Kavanaugh and Thomas kind of suggested this could be used to overturn Obergefell, and also the Texas case regarding sodomy, meaning there is no substantive due process. These aren't matters of fundamental rights or law. So therefore, the states can indeed regulate these things. And of course, there is no 14th Amendment right to gay marriage. That's just absurd. But so it opens up an avenue to overturn some of these other hard decisions that the Supreme Court has given us over so many decades.
Yeah, I mean, substantive due process is another word for social engineering. And it was one of the main ways that the oligarchs imposed their will on the majority of the people. No one in America ever voted for abortion. No one ever voted for gay marriage, unlike countries like Ireland, where I've been talking to Jim O'Doherty there about the horrendous situation over there. This was imposed on people who felt that they knew better, that they had a goal in mind. I think it goes all the way back to the Black Douglas clique. Those two people in the Warren Court that gave us the Griswold the law striking down the sale of contraceptives, they knew what they wanted, and so you just make up after the fact the wording to basically give you what you want, and you make up things like emanation from a penumbra, which is preposterous. And make up things like the Kennedy mystery clause in the Casey decision.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things, what do all of these things have in common? The common denominator here is that truth is the opinion of the powerful. That's what it is. And so you can say whatever you want, no matter how absurd, and if you have the backing of some type of powerful institution like the New York Times, it's true. And this is the essence of Jewish privilege, okay? If you say it and you're powerful, it is true. Well, it worked for a while. I mean, 49 years is a significant amount of time, but eventually, it's not true. It's just not true. I mentioned this in an article, but I went over to Notre Dame to cover Eleanor Schmiel, who was giving a talk about abortion. She was head of the National Organization of Women, and she finished her talk, and I said, does the fetus have sex? She didn't know what I was saying, so I said, well, is it recognizable as male or female? Is the fetus either male or female? And then she said, the process of sexual individuation starts at birth. I'm thinking, oh, well, that's interesting. Did any of the obstetricians notice this? Is anyone in the biology department here at Notre Dame going to back that statement up? So I started to write it down, and she says, don't write that down. You got me crazy. Well, wait a minute. What's going on here? This is a preposterous claim. She can make it because there's this powerful organization called the National Organization of Women, made up of women who are guilt-ridden because of the abortions they had and are now mobilized by the Democratic Party to be a power in getting people out to vote. And she said it, so therefore it's true. Well, it turns out it doesn't work that way. It's very similar to what's happening in the Ukraine right now. You remember how the Ukraine was winning all the time? You know, the what was that? The ghost of Kiev. He shot down 40 planes in 5 minutes. Well, it turns out he didn't. And it turns out they're not winning. And it turns out that this is another fantasy concocted by people who think that truth is the opinion of the powerful that is being disproven by categories of reality over which they have no control. And that is, I think, the story of consciousness. That's the story of what's happening now. And this overreach, this imperial overreach is over. It's going back to the States. We're going to have Kristi Noem of North Dakota said, yes, we're going to prosecute people who get abortions. Any abortionist here will be prosecuted, which is the opposite now of what people like Larry Krasner of Philadelphia are saying, which is basically, we don't care what the law is. We're not going to enforce any laws here. And so you have this division all coming about because of the bad law that you passed 49 years ago. And now we have to live with the consequences of this.
Yeah. The now with you said the importance of narrative and in this and controlling this public perception of reality. And we saw in the course with the January 6th committee hearings, it's spun or described as a insurrectionist white supremacist insurrection. I don't know where they get that from. Even Joe Biden said that. But it's interesting because in the opening remarks, I think it was the chairman Benny Thompson Louisiana or Mississippi, I forget. But he immediately starts talking about that he's black and he starts talking about the Klan and slavery. As if this has anything to do with the events on January 6th. But nevertheless, that's an attempt to spin the narrative, make it a racial issue when it indeed was not. And then again, label these people as non-citizens because they have no rights if you are a white supremacist, right?
Right, right. You impose – the whole point of this type of cultural battle is to impose categories of the mind on your opponent.
Mm-hmm.
So if you succeed, we saw this with Canada, with the trucker convoy. The truckers came from Western Canada. They were upset about the COVID regulations, and it was inhibiting their ability to earn a living. So what does Justin Trudeau do? Does he sit down with them, say, "Well, we're all fellow Canadians here. We can all get together, and we'll just figure it out." So obviously, COVID is not going to last forever, so we'll talk about how it's going to end, and everyone will be happy. Did he do that? No, he immediately saw his own people, the people of Canada, as his enemy, and then he imposed a category of the mind on them, called them Nazis, called them white supremacists. Well, as soon as you become a white supremacist or a Nazi, you become a fetus. And as soon as you become a fetus, you have no rights whatsoever. You don't even have the right to life. And then they acted on that principle. The same way with that lady who said, honk, honk equals Heil Hitler. Why are people like this taken seriously? Well, because truth is the opinion of the powerful, damn it. And the newspapers, which, by the way, have all been bought off by the government in Canada, they are all subsidiaries of government funding. They agree with this and they take these people seriously. And so you have a catastrophe there.
Yeah. Well, one thing that was funny is I just read a headline the other day, Trudeau warns that loss of abortion rights could lead to loss of other rights. This is Trudeau, the same Trudeau that locked his country down, is warning us of our loss of rights.
How long is this absurdity going to go on here? I mean, this is so out of contact with reality.
Or the lieutenant governor of California calling Clarence Thomas, equating him to some sort of Islamic radical or something, Shia radical because of his decision. But she accuses him of that, and she invokes bodily autonomy when just a few months ago she was forcing injecting people with experimental gene therapy drug. I mean,
yeah. So here's another interesting thing, like this attack. Samuel Jackson attacks Clarence Thomas, calls him didn't call him this, but Uncle Tom, calls him Uncle Clarence, and then Whoopi Goldberg joins in. And then we have Lori Lightfoot joining in. Now, all these black people are attacking fellow black man Clarence Thomas. What's going on here? What's going on here is that race is absolutely meaningless here. I've been saying this for years. The white boys always get their knickers in a twist when I talk this way. But the fact of the matter is, it's not Clarence Thomas' skin color that's the big issue here. It's his Catholicism. He's a Catholic.
Well, then Samuel Jackson, Lori Lightfoot, and all Whoopi Goldberg are simply following their Jewish masters, right?
Yeah. I mean, why do you think her name is Whoopi Goldberg? Do you think she was born that way? She took that name because when the agents go over the list, hey, we got a Jew here. We'll hire her. It's ridiculous. So this, again, shows you that the fault lines here, the ethnic fault lines in America, are religious.
Well, it's the same like that thing down in St. Louis with Louis the Ninth statue. It was a Jewish black cop. They just got the blacks to show up.
Yeah. That's right. And the guy who claimed to be black was white, actually.
Well, why not?
And he called himself a Muslim. So, I mean, if a man could call himself a woman, why can't a white person say he's black? He talked black. He sounded black when he talked. But so you're right. The fault lines there were religious and ethnic, but the battle was over the category of the mind or the label that got imposed on the people. So Umar Lee, the first thing he does is says it's white supremacists who are defending Louis the Ninth. I didn't know Louis the Ninth was a white supremacist. He didn't even know he was white, did he? I mean, when did the idea ever occur to people that they were white? Certainly not in France in the 13th century. I guarantee you that.
Well, if he had been born 500 or 600 years later, he would have been a Klansman.
Yeah, this is the type of absurdity that is going on here. There's got to be a course correction here. Someone's got to step in here. And we're all hoping that the elections in the fall will bring about this course correction. I saw an article saying that 1 million Democrats have registered now as Republicans.
Well, it's hard to worry about, you know, I guess a right to abort your child when you're paying $6 a gallon for gasoline. Right. I mean, that's why they're trying to make an issue out of it, trying to mobilize the base. I don't think there's as much passion, at least among normal people, for infanticide as the Democratic Party of the media, like to portray. A lot of supposed nights of rage or something didn't really happen. You've had a few protests in there, but you can always muster a few, miscreants to stage a protest anywhere in the country now.
Then play it up in the media.
Yeah, then there's enough, I mean, crazy women, cucked men, and people who will show up because the past, what they've done to the culture the past 60 years, they're grooming, they're destroying families and grooming the children of these disrupted families to become homosexual and transgender people in the schools. So yeah, you can really screw a generation up or a couple of generations if you're dedicated to doing that.
Yeah, and the problem is that the government has been dedicated to doing this. It's called social engineering, and basically it began with World War II, when you have 11 million men being subjected to the most ruthless form of social engineering, which is called military service. And then when they come back, and then there's just another form of social engineering imposed on them with the destruction of ethnic neighborhoods and the promotion of sexual liberation. And so they're weakened. And then the next generation comes along, my generation, the baby boomer generation, and it gets worse. It gets more intense. So, once the anti-war movement started, the CIA got involved and they had already gotten involved with MKUltra, which is experimenting with LSD. Well, let's feed it to those teenagers. What could go wrong here? And they did. And basically, the evil genius behind this whole thing was Aldous Huxley. And he wrote Brave New World. It came out in 1932. And that was the future, according to a certain group of people. And he talked to a lot because he was part of the English aristocracy. His grandfather was T.H. Huxley, the man who was called Darwin's bulldog. And so he was in on these conversations, and he comes up with this novel. And after the 25th anniversary of the publication of Brave New World, he gave a speech in which he said, you know, I read 1984. I think my book is better because I think it's easier to control people with pleasure than it is with force and pain. And he was referring to the Soviet Union at that time, which is what Orwell's book was about. And I think he was right. So he wanted to create a regime that would keep people docile and happy. Those are his words. And drugs were a part of it. And he went through the drugs, basically the barbiturates that were Mother's Little Helper that the Rolling Stones sang about, that bored housewives were taking during this period of time. And then when the anti-war movement starts to rear its head, the government gets involved with LSD. And it goes, you know, then we have Prozac. And then we have the final, I think everyone's settled on the drug now, which is marijuana. It's not perfect, but it's the best combination of what Huxley felt was needed to keep people docile and happy. And what you've done is basically wreck an entire generation. I'm talking about my generation.
Yeah, isn't Trudeau legalizing drugs in Canada at the same time? And he's imposing maintaining all these restrictions and also taking their guns.
That would make perfect sense. Yeah. I just did an article. It will appear in the next issue of Culture Wars about the marijuana decriminalization in Michigan. These are the people that elected. I talked to the guy who did it, so I got firsthand information, who basically mobilized the drug dealers to support Dana Nessel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dana's not going to, you know, they like brought about the legalization of this drug. This drug is now going to be a weapon that will be used against the people of Michigan keep them docile and happy.
And she's an advocate of sexual revolution and drug use. So
that's right. So we know where she stands. The irony. Okay, so I mentioned the plot. The kidnapping plot that Dana Nessel came up with, concocted with the FBI. So they're getting to the testimony in the trial. We're going through the usual stuff. The FBI gave him automatic weapons, and the FBI gave him bombs. But the new wrinkle is the FBI is giving them marijuana too. So the defense attorney says, You can't listen to what these guys are saying. They're all high on drugs. No one, who cares what they're saying? You can't take it seriously. And it's the FBI that gave them drugs. This is the world we live in right now. This is how the government wages war on the people that it's supposed to represent. You can't elect a Jewish lesbian and expect her to represent normal people. It's not going to happen. She hates normal people. It's obvious from everything she says. She likes drag queens in every school.
Yes.
Only someone who hated everything normal about sexuality and everything normal about the way people come into this world, only someone like that could make a statement like that.
Yeah, I was a couple of weeks ago when Ryan Kelly, the gubernatorial candidate in Michigan, I think he's the leading Republican contender, you know, to take on Whitmore, was arrested by the FBI for committing the horrendous crime of showing up at the Capitol on January 6th. He's arrested, dragged out of his house, you know, put in jail for the night, and charged with a misdemeanor conspiracy, whatever that is, by the FBI. And at the same time, then I'm thinking, well, I look up his family, and I think he has 6 or 7 children. And a wife who looks like she just recently has a small child, so she gave birth in the last year, and she has this big traditional-looking family, and I said, well, that's why they hate this guy.
Yeah, I mean, these
more than his politics. I mean, that's metapolitical there.
I hate to use this term, but these are Gestapo tactics,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And I apologize to all the Gestapo out there. You know, this is horrendous. This is not what America is supposed to be. The police, that I talked to in South Bend say that it's their job to protect the people. No, that's not the way the FBI is being weaponized under Merrick Garland. They're going after the people. They're trying to destroy anyone who contests their narrative, And it's a crazy narrative, and it's getting crazier by the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's becoming, the reaction is becoming more and more draconian, more and more out of contact with reality. Somebody's got to wake up here and get these people's hands off the steering wheel before they drive the car off the cliff.
Yeah, it's almost like they don't care about the optics anymore. It's like
optics.
They're not going to look
like
good.
Drag queen story hour.
Yeah.
What you mean those optics? Now it looks so. I do a show about Ireland, and Gemma puts up this story of a drag queen who exposes his genitals to a bunch of children. Oh, there's nothing wrong with that, right? So now it turns out that a week later, we got the same thing with the gay pride parade in Los Angeles, where all these men are riding around in front of children mm-hmm. on bicycles, exposing their genitals to children. Now, where is this going to stop? I mean, is there some type of limit here, or this is the principle here? We're going to transgress every limit. That is what we're about. That's the Jewish war on logos. That's the homosexual and transgender war on gender reality. That's what we're faced with. You have to. These are people who have to be stopped because they have no internal sense of limit. The only limits they know are the ones they long to transgress. They're compelled to do this, and we can't let this go on any further.
You said in the article that you recently penned regarding the reversal of Roe, the end of Roe, that this signals the beginning of the end of Jewish domination of culture. Is this the beginning of the end?
I think so. I mean, some people are accusing me of wishful thinking. But I think that we're talking about it wasn't just Roe. I mentioned those other things that basically cemented the rise of Jewish power over all of us.
Yeah, the Holocaust narrative, which is only about 54 years old, really. Yeah.
I mean, you can trace it back as far as you want, but it doesn't go back any farther than World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the end of World War II. But we're talking about. I'm saying that. I mean, Elie Wiesel's book came out in 1959, 58, around the same time of the attack on Pius XII. But I'm saying, as a real mainstream phenomenon, mm-hmm. it was the New York Times and Yeshe Kaczynski. They made that book. That had a huge effect on literature. A huge effect on literature. And I deal with this in the book that's going to come out, the Holocaust narrative book. But a man like... William Styron, okay, respected Southern author.
Sophie's Choice, right?
Yeah. But before that, it was The Confessions of Nat Turner, which everybody thought was a serious book. At that point, he's friends with Yeshe Kaczynski.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, they're friends. They hang out together. They come up to his house. He dismissed him later in life as a con man, but that's not the way he was talking back then. So Styron's looking around. All you have to do is read Sophie's Choice. There's a Jewish character, Nathan, in there, who tells the Southern character, which is obviously Styron, that Southern fiction is a busted flush. It's over. You have to get on and do Jewish fiction. Well, of course, that's what he does. That's what Sophie's Choice is. He basically took the advice. He wrote his Holocaust novel, and then he sank into depression and never wrote another thing for the rest of his life. So, what he did was bring about the demise of fiction, because this is the pen club. This was a battle over reality, because Yeshe Kaczynski sold that book to the public as a memoir. Okay, that he, as a little boy, first of all Holocaust narratives are little boys. It's like Elie Wiesel's book. A lot of it after that, it's like little children experiencing this thing, which gives you got a leeway mm-hmm. in terms of veracity. So anyway, it's the God's honest truth. And then there are people who upset, like the Poles are upset, because basically the Poles are the villain of this book, and they start looking into it, and they start to realize, no, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. There's something wrong here. And so it comes down to a battle over the truth. Of the book. Is it true or not? The only reason people took them seriously is because they thought it was a memoir and because it was true. And it turns out that he made it up. He made it up. Okay, now, we come here to a crucial turning point. So he becomes famous. He becomes the head of Penn, whatever that writer's organization stands for, poets, essayists, and novelists, which is the writer's, that's the Writers Guild in America. He becomes the president. And then it turns out, first of all, not only did he make up the story, because he wasn't alone in Poland. He was with his family. And not only that, the Polish people he demonized risked their lives to save his family. So how's that for gratitude? And the Poles are getting more and more annoyed at this. And finally, they break through the isolation that has been imposed on them because they're Poles and they're for obscure Polish journals that are published out of Chicago and they can't contest anything the New York Times says. So the New York Times comes back and one of the Zalzburgers, or I forget which, the Zalzburger clique says, we're going to double down. We're going to defend Jesse Kaczynski. And then the Village Voice comes out and just blows him out of the water. You know, so it turns out, well, it does matter whether it's true and it's not true. And what you said is not true. And we're all up. And he was destroyed because of that, left in disgrace and ended up committing suicide. So it turns out it is true. But the press, again, you set these precedents. So he set a precedent for the Holocaust narrative that doesn't have to be true. He made it up, but so what? It was a good story.
Well, the narrative matters more than the truth, right?
The narrative determines the truth.
Yeah.
Not the truth determines the narrative. So as the Italians say, non è vero mai ben trovato. It's not true, but it's a great story. So then you have... Then you have a crucial turning point here. Then you got Benjamin Wilkomirski writes a book called Fragments. Well, first of all, his name is not Benjamin Wilkomirski. It's Dosiker. He's not a Jew from Latvia. He's a Catholic from Belgium. No, he's a Swiss guy, okay? And that blows up because 60 Minutes gets involved, and they blow that story out of the water. And then there's Misha and the Wolves. Now, there's a really incredible story. She, 9-year-old girl, Jewish girl from Belgium, travels 900 miles across Europe in a pack of wolves to rescue her parents from Auschwitz. What a story. Well, it was crazy. It didn't happen. And her name was not Misha Defoneska. It turns out she was a Belgian Catholic. I forget what her name was. Okay. DeVales, I think her was. And she made it up because her father was a collaborator and she felt bad about that. So at this point, you establish the fact it doesn't have to be true. If it's the Jew saying it, it's true because he's powerful, because truth is the opinion of powerful. And the Holocaust is a really important issue. And so the crucial turning point comes in 1993. When Schindler's List comes out and, wait a minute. Remember the gas chamber in Schindler's List? You remember what it was?
It was a shower.
It's
actual
hot
shower,
water.
Yeah.
It's hot water. It's not gas. Spielberg became a Holocaust denier with that movie. He denied one of the fundamental tenets of the Holocaust, which is the gas chamber. The same year he does that, Debbie Lipstadt creates the category of mind called Holocaust denial. 1 year after Schindler does the list, he creates the Shoah Foundation, and he encourages people to come forward and give their testimony. And at this point, hordes of people, 50,000 people show up, and they make no attempt whatsoever to check the accuracy of what they're saying, because truth is the opinion of the powerful. Well, that's not going to last. None of these things are going to last because truth is not the opinion of the powerful. Truth is the correspondence between mind and the thing. And if there's no correspondence between the mind and the thing, it's not real. And that's it. That's the legacy. I'm saying simultaneously, it's the legacy of Roe versus Wade. It's the legacy of the Holocaust narrative. These things are going to come. They're going to fall together. It's the legacy of the state of Israel, where you can shoot a journalist, a well-aimed bullet kills the journalist, American citizen. But hey, they have Jewish privilege, so nothing's going to happen to whatever Israeli killed that Palestinian journalist. I'm saying this is all going to fall, because what my contention is that with Roe versus Wade, the Jews imposed their religion on the entire people of the United States of America. And that has been revoked. And so we no longer have the state religion. And so as a result, they are going to lose their power.
Will the Holocaust narrative pop the same way, like a bubble? The same way remember Roe was settled law. It was settled law. They kept saying that. They kept repeating settled law, right? Now it's gone.
And now it's not. It's not settled law. All those examples, how many examples do I have to give you of the bubble popping here?
Yeah.
I mean, Yeshi Kaczynski, Binyamin Wilkomirski, Misha Difonesca, the Rosenblatts. Remember the Rosenblatts on Oprah? Mm-hmm. Where the lady throws an apple over the fence every day, you know, and he survives Auschwitz because she's throwing apples over the fence, and he bumps into her in Coney Island. They get married. It's a beautiful love story. There wasn't a dry eye in the audience. Oh, but it didn't happen. So what's he say? Well, it was true in my mind. Sorry, truth is the correspondence between mind and thing. You can't have truth just in your mind. There's one mind in which the thought becomes a reality, and that's the mind of God. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
So what you're saying, these are literary works, stories, even movies, and those are very powerful because evidently most people's perception of history and reality is through this technology, whether it's the novel, the movie, and it gets reinforced. And that's why I guess perhaps, you know, something like Hollywood has been so important in promoting these things. You mentioned Schindler's List, of course. Most people's idea of the Holocaust is something like Schindler's List or a miniseries or another movie. There's several thousand movies that have been made where either Holocaust is the main story or it's a backdrop or something to the story. And so it's got a hold on people's consciousness or on their mind, burned into their DNA at this point. And so this is the power of the Holocaust narrative and how it relates to something like abortion, because the Jews were able to impose abortion on the country because their cultural, political, economic power, which was greatly enhanced by the outcome of the Second World War, of course, and the Holocaust narrative. Is that correct?
Yeah, they reinforce each other. Mm-hmm. And what comes across is Jewish privilege. Basically, you've created a class of people that are above criticism.
Mm-hmm.
That's the term anti-Semitism means this group is a group you cannot criticize. The term anti-Semitism is completely meaningless. That's why the ADL likes to use it so much. They use it against anyone who criticizes their behavior.
So instead of outlawing anti-Semitism, it actually imposes philo-Semitism.
Of course it does.
Yeah.
It imposes thought control on the population, and it imposes a mechanism whereby you can destroy anyone. If you bring up the term anti-Semitism, you're toast. That's it. And they've waged this ruthless battle against the entire country. But again, these things are all narratives, and the narratives come into being, and then they go out of being. And
well,
I
it
think
was,
that's what's happening.
Yeah, this is a conflict because look at something like take the United States, for example, and its experience. So obviously, the migration or immigration of the 19th century, particularly large inflows of Catholics in the 19th century, Irish and German in the 19th century. And then in the 1880s, 1890s, you have the Jews coming in from Russia or Eastern Europe. And that has a profound impact on the country. It creates this ethnic conflict in America, which you write about, which is the Protestant, Catholic, and Jew conflict. This sort of this how the ethnic mosaic of the country. But now what we've had with the Jews successfully taking control of Hollywood, they were able to they brag about this. It's Hollywoodism, where Neil Gabler writes about this in Empire of Their Own, that it's the Jew-shaped idea of Americanism, America.
Right.
And so now we have a situation, well, because of something like the events of the 20th century, is that the normal, or the historical, I guess you could say, barriers or protections that Christian society would put up to protect themselves against something like an alien population like the Jews are no longer considered, well, acceptable. So now, under the myth of liberalism, we're not supposed to think that ethnicity matters. But the only problem is it matters a lot to Jews, and they organize in that principle. And it only says everyone else, particularly white ethnics, can't organize in that principle. So now we have this idea in America where it's a creedal nation, ideas, the a matter of the country, it's a civic nationalism. But we have a group which organizes ethnically and has gained incredible economic, cultural, and political power. Now is mobilizing against the host population. And we're denied the grammar and even the consciousness to fight back in any meaningful way. One institution that may provide that is perhaps the Catholic Church. And this 50-year battle regarding abortion, I think, is an indication of how much power the Catholic Church can have. Because although the decision recently to overturn Roe in Dodd and Casey to overturn Casey and Roe, it's a legal decision, but it's backed up by the moral force behind it, meaning that it mobilized troops, it kept people on it, it motivated the politics, which turned things around in this decision, and it is an indication of how much potential power something like a Catholic consciousness can have on our society. Would you agree?
That's right. That's right. The church never backed down on the abortion issue. You could say they caved in many ways on the contraception issue, but they never backed down on the abortion issue. But they were weakened as a cultural force, largely because of the Second Vatican Council doctrine on other religions, Nostra Aetate, on the Jews. This was passed at the end. I have made it's in the next issue, my review of Zewald's book of biography of Cardinal of Joseph Ratzinger. I try to make the point that at Vatican II, Ratzinger, as a German who had internalized the commands of his oppressors, namely the Americans and the Jewish social engineers, imposed the Holocaust narrative on the Catholic Church at that time. The implementation of it was known as Catholic-Jewish dialogue, which made basically the Catholics had to apologize for everything, and the Jews never collaborated on anything. This the first sign of how this was going to go happened immediately. Immediately. I'm talking about 1965, and I'm talking about the bulwark of Catholic resistance to cultural aggression, which was the Legion of Decency and the Production Code, which had reigned Hollywood in the Jews in Hollywood in for 31 years. The movie that broke the code was The Pawnbroker, and The Pawnbroker was a Holocaust movie, a Holocaust porn movie. This shows you the power of the Holocaust narrative and how it got weaponized to destroy any type of cultural opposition to Jewish power. This is what happened here. The film broke the code. A black woman playing a black prostitute exposed her breast. That broke the code. But the Catholics were paralyzed because it was the Holocaust. And we're not allowed to criticize the Holocaust. That was a terrible thing. And so they used it to break the code. And within years, 7 years, you have hardcore pornography on first-run theaters, when first-run theaters were significant. And then you had Jews taking over the culture through pornography and all the stuff that I've just been talking about tonight. You know, abortion, pornography, the subversion of sexual morality destroyed an entire generation. I'm writing a review of a book, a memoir, a Catholic woman who wrote the story. That'll be in the next issue, upcoming issue of Culture Wars as well. It had a devastating effect because the Christian population of America understood that there was something important about maintaining sexual morality, but they weren't sophisticated enough to know, first of all, that there was such a thing as social engineering. Secondly, that sexual liberation was one of the crucial weapons in the arsenal of social engineering, and that it was important to maintain these standards. And if you didn't, your culture would be destroyed. Well, that's what we had to learn the hard way, because no one knew it then. No one understood it. You had to learn that in the expensive school of experience.
Yeah. And everything in media is dedicated to leading people towards their own destruction, you know, in their lives and of course, then beyond.
That's right.
Sending them to hell, whether it's the television or the big silver screen or their little pocket hell devices they carry around with them now. And there's no restriction on what can be transmitted through those devices. And regardless of how young the eyes are, they're looking at it. And
how is it that we can ban what the Jews call hate speech, but nobody can ban pornography? Well, the answer is because the Jews control your culture. That's why. Mm-hmm. If Catholics controlled your culture, it would be the opposite.
Well, even acknowledging the reality of Jewish power is crushed by Jewish. Jewish power prevents you from acknowledging Jewish power.
That's right.
It's not polite to say that it exists. And if you do, then Jewish power will crush you.
That's right.
And
or they will try. And I'm saying that the times are changing. And if they haven't crushed me, I mean, believe me, you can survive. Because they've been waging a campaign against me ever since word got out that I was writing The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. And that is now 13 years ago.
Well, I mean, again, they brag about it. Like you've said it before, they'll brag about it, take credit for it. And if you turn around and blame them for it, they call you anti-Semite.
Right.
And you're both admitting the same thing, whether it's pornography or even the overall impact of the culture. Like Neil Gable's book, Empire of Their Own, where he says that a handful of Jews shaped American identity and culture and where it goes. So if you're not happy where American culture is today, and they take credit for it, they also have to accept responsibility for it. You know,
that's right.
And they can't have it both ways. But I guess they think they can if you control a public discourse. The main way they control public discourse is, of course, is the accusation of anti-Semitism, which is rapidly losing its sting. People kind of increasingly rolling their eyes at it, which is indication that it is that Jewish power is in decline.
Is waning.
Yeah.
And the very fact that they have to get draconian and enforce, create things like Holocaust denial laws in places like Europe is a sign that you lost the debate.
Those are relatively recent, aren't they? I mean, that was.
These are all in the wake of the 90s. They're all phenomena of the 90s. We had an example, the case of Father Oko, the Polish priest who. Mm-hmm. Wrote a book about the Lavender Mafia. He was accused of racial incitement, Volksverhetzung, by another Catholic priest, a homosexual Catholic priest from Bavaria, Germany. Well, Volksverhetzung, that means, folk means ethnic group. So homosexuals are an ethnic group now? I didn't know that. Well, that's what happened. The judge in Germany created a kind of compromise situation. So he upheld the law and basically let Father Oko off with a slap on the wrist. It didn't resolve the issue, though.
No. I mean, that's ridiculous. What you're saying is that traditional Christian or Catholic moral teachings are illegal, essentially.
Yeah, they're considered racial incitement.
Go and sin no more. Arrest that man.
What? Well, this is the way this expands.
Well, it was in California where they banned reparative therapy or something because.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Joe Nicolosi's our success in getting homosexuals to give up their lifestyle, their sinful behavior, was banned by the state of California, which proves it was effective and proves that. You know, they had to resort to these draconian measures.
Well, how does that comport with the First Amendment? Am I being naive?
Good question.
I mean, does confession count as reparative therapy if you go to confession?
Look,
all of this
will go down the drain. What the operative principle is, truth is the opinion of the powerful, and that's what we have to contest because that's the essence of Jewish privilege.
And what they do is they create a generation of psychologically damaged people who can't think clearly about these things. All they want is their sex, and you have these crazy women, you know, yelling at you. And by that, not just approaches. I'm thinking about like representatives like Anna Costa Cortez and Elizabeth Warren. I mean, jeez.
Wait, Elizabeth, did you have an abortion?
Yeah.
Somehow this question never gets asked. This is the demonic nature of the Democratic Party in that they encourage abortion because they know that these silly women will be obsessed with their sins. The guilt will rule their lives and they will go to their graves shouting defiance at the God that that created the moral law that they transgressed. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not true for everyone. There are women who have abortions who wake up one day and they repent and they lead. They can go on to lead, lives and be saved, productive lives and be saved, even though you can never bring that child back. That's the story that I'm going to be reviewing in the upcoming issue. A woman who did make it back, but full disclosure I have to say that I played a role in that because she couldn't understand how sexual liberation could be used as a form of control until she read Libido Dominandi. So the consciousness is rising, Logos is rising. Mm-hmm. And whenever Logos rises, the people who rejected Logos and crucified the Logos incarnate lose their power. And I think that's the way the tide is going now. So if you want abortion as a sacrament, move to Greenwich Village. But it's not going to be that way in Mississippi. And that's what you're going to see. The power is going to go back to the states. It's a win for representative government.
Do the Jews in New York really care about people in Mississippi not being able to obtain an abortion or have to do it, can't do it after 12 weeks or whatever? I mean, even the laws that are being passed are liberal in a historical standard, because I think prior to Roe v. Wade, 30 states banned abortion outright. I mean, you couldn't get it. But this is the product, again, of the 50 years of sexual revolution and cultural warfare, is the people have been so corrupted in these things and their whole attitude towards sex and sort of the decline of public morality in these things, just public decorum and propriety. And this is all a fruit of that, you know.
Yeah.
Bitter fruit. And we're seeing that now. So, well, I think we covered it. I think you made the case that you tie in the abortion as a Jewish sacrament to the Holocaust narrative and how those things are kind of connected to maintaining Jewish power and the Jewish role in promoting all these things. And then they admit it because they're the ones that say, hey, wait a second. It isn't an issue of the First Amendment, not the of Fourth Amendment or 14th Amendment. It isn't a privacy issue, rather, nor is it undue burden. It's a religious right. Okay.
I finally agree with the ADL.
Yeah, okay. It's a religious right. Wow. Okay.
That's not going to fly. That's over. That's dead in the water. It's not going anywhere. They blew it. Okay. The tide's running. First of all, we're not going to allow the Jews to impose their religion on us again explicitly. That's not going to happen.
Well, I think what Yuri Susskind calls the 20th century the Jewish century.
Right, and the 20th century is over, in case you haven't noticed.
Yeah. Yes. And they sped it along with the 9/11, but so that's, again, the cunning of reason. So with all the crises they've created,
right,
these things happen for a reason. So
that's right.
Well, I'm going to let you. I usually have you for an hour. I think we covered it. So thank you for coming back on the show. That's great. Of course, that's E. Michael Jones, the editor of Culture Wars magazine, culturewars.com. That's where you can get the books that we've mentioned. And, of course, the new book coming out hopefully in days. The title again?
The Dangers of Beauty, the battle, the conflict between concupiscence, between mimesis and concupiscence in the fine arts. A book on aesthetics, a neglected part of philosophy that I think needs to be brought back, because beauty is a transcendental. Beauty gives you direct access to being, and being is the attribute of God. So even if you're stupid and even if you're immoral, beauty can bring you into the presence of God.
Yes, and this is why the modern world wants to accentuate the ugly so much.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll let you go. Thank you so much. Maybe we'll talk soon. And
thank you, Tim. It's always a pleasure.
Good night, then. Bye-bye.
One, two, three, four.
The memories of a man in his old age. The deeds of a man in his prime. You shuffle in the gloom of the sick room and talk to yourself as you die. And life is a show. short, warm moment, and death is a long, cold rest. You get your chance to try in a twinkling of an eye, 80 years with luck or even less. So all aboard for the American tour, and maybe you'll make it to the top. But mind how you go, and I can tell you, 'cause I know, you may find it hard to get off. Shuffle in the gloom of the sick room and talk to yourself.